on page 7 is one of the most sensational exercises that Carol and I have ever done together. I probably ought to take a minute and tell you about this because it is so good. Several years ago, we came across this, and we decided to do it, and we were instructed how to do it, each of you separately, which is basically the way you do all these assignments. You fill them in separately, and then you get together and talk about them. And this one you fill in, and you as an individual husband, you as an individual wife, you evaluate where you think you are in your marriage relationship in terms of these 12 areas of intimacy on a scale of 1 to 7. 1 being very dissatisfactory, and 7 being, you know, we're doing tremendous. And you each one go down and you just put a little check mark where you think you are. That doesn't take very long, usually. But then you get together when you got a good chunk of time. We did this when we were taking a trip in the car, and we were going to be in the car about 8 hours. And we began to talk our way through this and seeing where we were both coming from. We were not together on any one of these in terms of our evaluation of 1 to 7. And so we had a lot to talk about. And we talked about this going in the car and a trip. And you know, some of them really didn't mean that too much to you, like aesthetics. We weren't into really aesthetic stuff. And so we didn't spend much time on that. But after we finished it and had talked our way through, and it had come to some pretty mutual agreements on stuff, what we needed to do and how to work on it, then we went back and we asked ourselves, okay, which one do we need to really work on the most right now, right at this point in our lives? And we thought about that for a minute, and I said, well, honey, I no question in my mind what it is. She says, really? I said, yeah. It's 7. Recreational intimacy. I've been into athletics all my life. Loved athletics. Played sports all through high school and college. Carol has been a terrific spectator. Never really gotten involved in athletics. And so as a result of that, we have, up to that point, we had never done anything together in terms of sports or athletics or anything like that. Well, she kind of agreed with me. Yeah, we really do need to do something together. Like, what do you think we could do? Well, we talked about this, that, and the other thing. We talked about golf, but that didn't have any appeal to her whatsoever. She could not see the point of chasing a little white ball around, you know. Yeah, not so fast there, Jones. And so we agreed on tennis. I had played a little tennis when I was in high school. She had never held a racket, but she'd always kind of been intrigued by tennis. And so we decided that when we got home, we were going to take a crack at tennis together. Well, right after we got home, we left on another trip and kind of forgot about it. And we got down to Birmingham, Alabama on this trip, and it was a ministry trip. And a friend of ours in Birmingham said, hey, I got a guy I want you to meet here in town. So he takes us out to a tennis club and introduces us to a pro, a tennis pro. And this guy has agreed to give us a lesson because we told our friend about our decision to try and get into something recreational together. Well, this tennis pro gets me across the net from him and he hits me one ball and I hit it back. He says, okay, that's enough. And he does the same with Carol. He gets her on the other side of the net and he hits a ball over to her and she swings at it and sort of hits it back. He says, okay, that's enough. Well, for the next half hour, he gave each of us a tennis lesson. It was absolutely unbelievable. I mean, all he had to do was see us hit a ball once, and he knew exactly where we were as far as our tennis ability or lack of ability, really. And then he ended up giving us rackets, a couple of cans of balls. We got home, and he told us how to practice and what we should do. And we got home and joined a little tennis club near where we lived. And we started playing tennis together. Had an absolute ball playing tennis together. So both of us were pretty good. We could play, you know, the male-female thing. She got both lanes. And I only got one. And I only got one serve. And she got 3 or 4. And so, but we had a great time. And then we got, you know, playing mixed doubles together. And then I had an old knee injury that recurred, and it got so bad I had to quit playing tennis. So, you know, we were back to number 7 again. One day we were driving along in the car, and I said, "Honey, do you suppose there's any way I could talk you into at least taking a crack at golf?" I'd played golf all my life. Loved it. Enjoyed it. Played with my dad when I was a kid. And she said, "Well, I'm not sure." Now, when she started playing tennis, she told me that she had to pray two things. Number one, that she would like it, because if she didn't like it, she wouldn't play. And number two, that she'd be good enough so that she wouldn't embarrass both of us. And God answered that prayer. She liked it, and she got good enough that, you know, we really had a great time. Well, she had to pray the same two things about golf, that she would like it, and at this point in time, she couldn't see any reason why she should like it. And secondly, that she'd get good enough at it so that she wouldn't embarrass both of us. Well, to make a long story short, we play golf together now. We have a ball. We travel quite a bit, and most of the time we take our clubs with us, and we'll get in a round of tour golf on most of our trips. And it's taken us to some wonderful places. And, you know, every tennis court in the world looks the same. Every golf course in the world is different. And you're outside in God's beauty. So, anyway, this guy down here, Mark, who is clapping, he sells golf equipment. So if you... So anyway, work your way through that one. Then the next one and the last one is communication skills as a listener. How good a listener are you? And folks, seriously, we would really encourage you to take these home with you and each week tackle a new one. You know, if you're going to start with the first one, understanding each other, don't try and do the whole thing all at once. Just take maybe the first three questions, do that one week, and then the next week, take the other three, fill it out individually, and then get together and talk about your answers. If you feel the heat rising, back off from it, you know, that type of thing. You know how to do that. So anyway, we trust that this will be a help to you as you take it home and work on it. All right, one more thing, and then we'll get started on the message. Just recently, our book entitled Marriage Takes More Than Love, which has been on the market for, I think, over 12 years, we did a revision on it. This is, some of you have got the white copy. This is the new one. And we're going to give you a copy of this tonight with one stipulation. And you probably know what that is. You got to read it. Yeah. You got to, oh. Now, if you're familiar, yes. Okay, I'm going to get to that in just a minute. If you will notice, when you go through it, if you're familiar with the old one, the new one is the same. Certain chapters I have written, certain chapters Carol has written. And what we want you to do is the chapters that I have written, you husbands, you read out loud to your wife. And then you talk about it together. Now, I'm making a giant assumption here. You guys can read, can't you? Okay. There aren't any pictures in it, I'm sorry. And then the chapters that Carol has written, you wives, read out loud to your husband, and then talk about the content of the chapter. Now, that's the deal. And after the meeting is over, there'll be a bunch of them over here on a table, and you can have one per couple. But you got to be honest before yourself and God that if you pick that up off the table, you're committed to going through it in the next couple of 3 months. And preferably the way I just described. You husbands, read the chapters I've written out loud, and then you talk about it. Does that get at it? Okay, good. So we hope it'll be a blessing to you. That's an $11 book. Good night. And we're giving it to you. see. You didn't know it was going to rain, did you? I want you to imagine that all the parts of your marriage can fit under this umbrella. Okay? Can you imagine that? You know, all the parts of your marriage. Including your sex life. Now, what do you suppose the umbrella represents? Well, it could be that. She said the protection of God. But I think God is bigger than this umbrella. But that's a good answer. That would fit under it, but it's not the umbrella. What do you think is pervasive throughout all the aspects of your marriage that touches every that should touch every aspect of your marriage? What? Right on, Jerry. Communication. This umbrella. Okay, here's your marriage down here. All aspects of it. This is communication. Communication should touch every aspect of your marriage relationship in one way or another at some point in time or other. Okay? And we're going to talk about that tonight. That's my golf umbrella. Isn't that neat? Man, that's extra big. Carol and I walk down the street with that above us, and people, you know, they look so jealous, they can hardly stand it. Just about every aspect of marriage should be well covered by the umbrella of communication. In fact, I can't think of any aspect of marriage or married life that doesn't need to be laced with the communication in order for it to thrive. But this is something that doesn't just happen. Good communication patterns have to be developed and worked at all of our married life. This is one of the aspects of when we say we need to work at our marriage, this is one of the things. It's probably the most important thing that we've got to work at, is this matter of communication. It's got to be a priority for both of us. It's not something you can put in neutral and just let it coast. Listen to what Howie and Jean Hendricks say about this. Here's a quote from them in a book that they've contributed to. Good marriages and poor marriages have one thing in common, communication. Happy unions and troubled ones face exactly the same problems. The differences lie in the ability of that couple to communicate. Either communication is free and open or it's choked. Nothing is as easy as talking, but nothing is as difficult as transparent communication. Difficult, yes, but completely doable. Communication is, now get this, communication is a developmental skill. I am an introvert. I have had to learn to be a good communicator in order to meet her needs, because she needs it. She not only needs a lot of communication going on between us, but she needs in-depth communication, which is something I was totally unfamiliar with when we got married. I was a small talk type communicator. I didn't know how to express my feelings. I didn't know how to get at things that were going on inside of me and put it into words so that she could understand. I had to learn that. Communication is a developmental skill. It is completely doable. Look at the components. Talking, listening, understanding, but there's one other, desire. And Howie and Jean refer to desire as the drive shaft of the first three. And I think they're right. There's an idiocy abroad, they say, that if you live together, eat, sleep, and store your stuff under the same roof, you'll grow together. Expert research seems to dismantle this fallacy. The secret is not where you live, but how you live. We communicate both verbally and non-verbally, and the messages must be congruent, not conflicting with our actions. Look at these statistics. Communication by words alone represents about 7% of the job. Tone of voice pushes it up to 38%. And facial expressions and body language represent 55% of good communication patterns. And we need to learn how to make all of those work for us in a good communication lifestyle. Communication is not what you say, but what your partner understands by what you say. That's what makes the difference. See, the true definition of good communication is the meeting of meanings. The meeting of meanings. When your meaning meets my understanding across the bridge of words and tone of voice and body language, then we have truly communicated. When communication breaks down in a marriage and continues for years, here's what could happen. I heard a story a number of years ago about a man who retired, and they, at that time, were living in a western suburb of Chicago. And so after he retired, he was around the house all the time. And, you know, it began to get on his wife's nerves because she was used to fixing him breakfast and supper, but he was around for lunch and he was there for coffee breaks, and they really didn't know what to talk about anymore when he was around so much of the time. Well, he began to realize that he was getting on his wife's nerves. So one day he was walking downtown. It's a little suburb of town. Walking downtown, and he walked by an office. And in the window of one of the offices, it said "Office for Rent." So he got an idea. He went in, inquired, and found the person who was the rental agent for the office. Found out it wasn't too expensive. It was kind of an old office building. It had one of these quaint wooden doors with a frosted glass window on the top, you know, kind of old-fashioned type thing. And so when he found out the price, he says, well, could I sign maybe a three-month lease just to make sure that this is going to work for me? Oh, yeah, that'll be fine. So he did. He put down some money on the... Went home, got a little rental trailer, hooked it up to the back of the car, and put in the car his favorite lounge chair, his desk and chair, his TV with a TV stand and a VCR, and a couch, and he hauled all that down to the office. And then after he'd moved everything in, he got a guy to come out and put a sign on the door, the glass frosted glass door, that said consultant. And so every morning now, he'd get up, they'd have breakfast, and he'd go to the office. Saved all kinds of hassle during the day. And then, you know, about 5:30, while he'd leave the office, go home and have dinner, and, you know, all they had to do was make the evenings work. So it smoothed things out quite a bit in their home. Well, about 3 or 4 weeks after he'd moved into his office, he was sitting there reading one of his favorite books, sitting in his lounge chair, and somebody knocked on the door. He went to the door, and there was an elderly gentleman standing there, and he said, are you a consultant? He says, yeah, I'm a consultant. He says, well, what kind of consultant are you? He says, what kind you need? And so this guy says, well, you see, I got this problem. I just recently retired. And he reiterated this guy's story. And after listening to him, he says, hey, look, there's plenty of room here in this office for two of us. Why don't you get your desk and, you know, we can share the TV and decide on which programs we're going to watch and get your lounge chair and you move in and we'll, you know, we'll make, it'll be cheaper for both of us. So he did. And the only thing they changed was they added an S to the word consultants. Now it was consultants. Now, don't think it couldn't happen to you. The divorce rate among people in their 50s and 60s is epidemic in our country today. And see, what had happened, partially what had happened to this couple, both of them, and to many, many others in our country today, is that they have neglected communication over the years. The only thing that has really kept their hearts in any way together is talking about the kids. But then all of a sudden, the kids have grown up and they're gone. They're what we call empty nesters. And they don't have anything to talk about anymore. And they make an attempt at it and they discover that it's just too high a price to pay. There's too much work in trying to get back what has slipped away from them gradually over the years. And so they opt for splitting. Where do you think God places the responsibility for something like that when it happens? Or where do you think God places the responsibility for preventing it from happening in the first place, which is even a better thing? Take a look at Ephesians chapter 5, verse 23. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 23. This is the great chapter on marriage in the Bible. I'd love to take the next hour and unload this on you, but we're just going to delve into it very briefly here. It says, "For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church." And verse 25 says, "Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church." Now, we're going to talk about that tomorrow morning, guys, in the split session. And how does that apply to us, and how can we fulfill that? But verse 23, "For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church." Headship involves a lot of things. But basically, it boils down to responsibility. And when you narrow headship down to what it really is talking about, it's basically talking about leadership, good leadership. And you put verse 23 and 25 together and it becomes a leadership of love, which is the way Christ did things. So that's what we've got to learn how to do. But headship or leadership, there are certain basic principles involved in being a good leader. One of those is you got to keep your troops, the people for whom you are responsible, you got to keep them informed. They got to know what's going on. You got to talk to them. You must communicate with them if you're going to be a good leader. And that's what this verse is talking about, is good leadership. Because the comparison is made as Christ was the head of the church. He's our example, guys. I'm talking to us husbands now. He is our example. Just on this issue of communication, let me ask you a question. Who initiated communication between Christ and his church? Christ or the church? Right. Christ did. Who made it possible for good communication to be maintained between Christ and his church? Christ or the church? Christ did. Okay, if he is our example, and we are to be the head of our wives, and communication is a good part of leadership or headship, then who is responsible to be sure that within the confines of your marriage there is good communication going on? Is it your responsibility or is it your wife's? Guys, there is absolutely no way in the world we can wiggle out of that one. God, through His Word, nails us right to the wall on that. It's our responsibility as husbands to make sure that there are good communication patterns developed between us and our wives. That is, if we're Christians and we want to obey God's Word. Now, guys, this is serious business. We're not playing games now. God isn't playing games with us. And I know some of you are sitting there and you're thinking to yourself, man, I am just I'm a lousy communicator. That's no cop-out. That's no excuse. You need to learn how to be a good communicator. If you're going to be the kind of a person that he's talking about here in Ephesians 5:23. And that's what we're talking about tonight. It is doable. It is doable. What did they say? It's a... if I can find it here. It's a developmental skill. We can learn how to do it. I've learned how to do it. I had to work hard at it. But man, the reward, the payoff has been phenomenal in our relationship as a husband and a wife. So I hope you accept the challenge. There is a statistic that's running around that says 40% of troubled marriages are characterized by the silent husband. Don't let that characterize your relationship. Learn how to talk. Learn how to communicate. Learn how to meet the need that your wife has for this interaction. Commit yourself to it. Dr. Eugene Nida has been translation secretary for the American Bible Society and the director of translations of the translation program for the United Bible Society. He is a foremost linguist. He has worked in some 75 countries, producing texts in over 200 different languages. Dr. Nida has written 22 books on translation, anthropology, communications, and missions, and he is one of the outstanding authorities on communications in the world, both in the secular world as well as the evangelical world. And here is a quote from him about communication. Now, he's a pro. He's an expert in this field. And here's what he says. No two people ever mean exactly the same thing by the same word. Well, he didn't make things any easier for us, did he? No two people ever mean exactly the same thing by the same word. Now, most of us here don't believe that. And one of the reasons we don't believe it is because of how we have been raised and schooled. From first grade on, we have been taught that meanings are in words. You want to find out what a word means? You go to the dictionary. What he is saying, though, is that meanings are not so much in words as they are in people. Meanings are in people. No two people ever mean exactly the same thing by the same word. So, therefore, meanings are in people. And I realize, that being true, and I believe it is, that it does make communication more complicated. But there are ways of getting around that that make communication a challenge. Good communication. The meeting of meanings. So, what that leads us to is something that Carol and I want to do a little role-playing with you on. It's called the feedback technique. That's what we call it. Someone else has just recently, we read, they referred to it as the drive-through technique. And we want to give you a little illustration of what we're talking about here. First of all, the drive-through technique. And you know what I'm talking about. You go down to Burger King and you're going to get food for the family for supper, and you go through the drive-through. You don't go inside and get it. You go through the drive-through. And so you pull up to the little speaker there, and over the speaker, a voice comes, and it says,
"May I help you?"
Yeah, I want one hamburger with everything. Let's see, one double with cheese, onions, ketchup, and pickle, a large fry, one medium Pepsi, and one large 7-Up.
Okay, that's one hamburger with everything, one double cheese with onions and ketchup, one medium fry, one large Pepsi, and one large 7-Up.
One double cheese with onions, ketchup and pickle, and one large fry and a medium Pepsi.
Oh, one hamburger with everything, one double cheese with onions, pickle, and ketchup, one large fry and one large Pepsi and 7-Up.
A medium Pepsi.
Oh, one medium Pepsi and one large 7-Up.
Right. Okay, thank you. You forgot the fries.
Oh.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, now let's get to real life. You know, hon, I've really been wondering if we should take that trip to Durango this weekend.
Oh, really? Yeah. Why not?
Well, I don't know. I'm just not sure we should go.
Well, are you feeling that it would stretch our budget and maybe we've got too many other things on our plate?
Well, no. I think we can afford it. It wouldn't be a bad idea to save that money for our next spring's vacation.
Oh, okay. So you feel we shouldn't go or can't do both, and that's probably taking away from your excitement right now.
Well, that's part of it. But you know, when we made the plans, I didn't realize that the U.S. Open was going to be on that weekend.
Ah. You'd rather stay home and watch the Open and save the weekend trip for another time.
Yeah, I think that's it. You see, she kept probing. Because I didn't come right out and tell her. I was veiling my real reasons. And that's what we got to do in communication. We got to keep probing, keep asking questions, keep feeding back to one another until we actually have a meeting of meanings where she understood where I was coming from and vice versa. And folks, we do this all the time. Now, I realize that at first, when you first begin to experiment with this, it may get a little intimidating. But you got to keep an open heart, and your goal, you got to keep that in mind. Your goal is to find out what the other person means, not just what they're saying. See, some people we run into, they're literalists, and they keep saying, "Well, that isn't what you said. What they said has got nothing to do with it. It's what they meant by what they said, and it's your job partly to find out what they meant by what they said." So stop being a literalist. Meanings are in people. They're not in words. We got to find out what they mean by the words they use, which may mean something different if we were to use the same words. I know that's tough. Communication is not easy, but it is doable. We can learn how to do it. You know, you use phrases like, "Well, if I'm hearing you, what you're saying, it is," and so you repeat it back to them in your own words. And then that gives them the opportunity to say, "Well, no, that isn't exactly it. What I really mean is..." And you go back and forth on that two or three times until you have a meeting of meanings. Do you mean If I'm understanding you, what you're saying is, these are phrases that you use in this process. Now, Carol is going to come up and talk about some blocks to good communication. You're on.
The parents were quite worried about a little boy who was not talking. He had said one word since he was born, and he was then about 4 years old. And they took him to all kinds of doctors, and the doctors couldn't find anything wrong with him. And one day at breakfast, the little boy finally said, "This toast is burnt." And his mother said, "You talked! You talked! Why haven't you talked before now?" And he said, "Well, up to now, everything's been okay." Illustrates two things that can block good communication. One is that we simply won't talk, and the other is a negative attitude. But there's a whole lot of things that block communication, and we're only going to take a couple. One of them is simply the rat race that we're in. We are so busy. We're way too busy. You heard about the husband who had his hand on the television knob, and he said, "Now, honey, is there anything you want to say to me before football season starts?" We are too busy. There are too many urgent things to tend to, too many appointments, obligations, requirements on our time, too much stuff on our calendars. Things that have to be done, or so we think. And work really does expand to meet the time that is available. In such a state, couples still will communicate about such things as, "Did you pick up the dry cleaning?" And "What time does Johnny have to be home from school?" But they forget to talk about their dreams, about their desires, about the fun things, about the what-ifs, and certainly the heavies are avoided at all costs. And that's when it breaks down, because we are simply too busy. Jack and I had the privilege of attending a seminar by Norm Wright, who I think of as Mr. Marriage Counselor. He's written about 50 books on marriage, and he is a professional marriage counselor out in the West Coast. And it was a seminar that profoundly affected our lives. Mr. Wright asked an engaged couple that he was counseling with if they would be willing for him to interview them in front of about 20 of us. And they had agreed to do this. And so Mr. Wright said to this young couple, "Tell me, what makes you think you're going to make it?" And they said, "Why, we really love each other." And he said, "Yes. What else?" "Well, we're really committed to each other." "Yes. What else?" "Well, we really feel this is God's will." "Yes. What else?" Well, he just kept asking this question until, of course, they ran out of answers, and all of us were getting a little uncomfortable here. And then he looked at them and he said, "You know, 90% of the couples that I get in my office ready to get a divorce have said the very same things you've said. Tell me, what makes you think you're going to make it?" Well, they had nothing more to say. And Mr. Wright, kindly but very firmly, he said, "Let me give you two suggestions that could make your marriage work for the long haul." And, of course, all of us were sitting on the edge of our chairs waiting for these two things. The first thing he said was, "Date. Date. Don't ever stop dating." Jack and I wanted to clap. Because it's one of the things that we have tried to do through the years that we've been married, to set aside a time once a week, that's our goal, to get away from the house. There have been times we haven't been able to afford anything but going out to White Rock Lake in Dallas, you know, and having a picnic and doing a little lovemaking out there. And or taking a walk around the block or whatever, but it was a date away, and we found that we would talk about things that we never talked about at home. So he said date. Part of the reason that Jack and I are more in love today than we were when we got married, and we thought we were totally in love when we got married. And not that it hasn't had its ups and downs, I don't mean that. But we really do love each other more than we did then. And part of it's been because we've kept the freshness. And part of that has been because we dated. And we still do that. Secondly, he said, put into your budget the time and money for some kind of a marriage retreat every year. Jack and I about fell off our chairs. You know, we give these, friends, but let me tell you something. They mean much more to us than anybody else. They really do. Why? Because we're continually reminding ourselves of what we ought to be working at all the time. And it helps. But what does that take? Well, it takes commitment, and it takes time. And sometimes you can't get away or afford to come to a place like this and have a marriage seminar, but you can always go away someplace, borrow a friend's home or trade homes with them, so you can turn off the phone, and take a good book or some tapes, take some exercises to do, and work on your marriage. And it'll keep your marriage fresh. But the rat race is a block to good communication. The kids often are a block to good communication. Kids don't plot to squeeze out time for adult communication, but it's the case often of the squeakiest axle that gets the grease, isn't it? They make demands and you meet them. And I don't mean that there aren't times when kids have to take priority. And marriage experts tell us over and over again that it's much more important that the kids know that mom and dad love each other and take time for each other than it is even that they take time and love the kids. So this is vital. You're only going to have kids for 20 years of your life, and hopefully you're going to be married for 60. That's a long time, isn't it, honey? Maybe we won't make that. The media is a block, especially TV. If it's true, as some research studies claim, that American couples communicate with each other an average of 27.5 minutes a week, that means many of us know much more about the marriages on some sitcoms than we do about our own. That's not good. And then, of course, lack of understanding one's spouse. And we've talked about that, but let me just stick in a couple more things here. Often we cut off communication because it is a tendency for a lot of men to want to fix a problem that their wives tell them instead of understanding that problem. Now, that isn't just true with husbands. I can still remember a time when Jack was going through something really heavy and really deep. And he poured out his heart to me, and I gave him a verse. And Jack looked at me, and he smiled, and he said, "Honey, I don't want a sermon. I just want you to understand me." And I thought, wow, yeah. But men somehow have more of a propensity to want to fix. Probably their T's coming out, their thinking. But they want to fix it for us. Well, we want those suggestions after we've been understood, really understood. And if we don't feel that understanding, it'll cut off communication right there. One solution to this is something that Keith and Gladys Hunt suggest, They say, we've made it a rule. Answer an idea with an idea, but a feeling with a feeling. It's as disconcerting to share a thoughtful idea and get an emotional response as it is to share an emotion and get an idea thrown back at you. We learned this rule one night after we had gone to bed. Here's what happened. Wife told husband about an apprehension she had. Husband, wishing to go to sleep, said she shouldn't feel that way. This only made her feel more that way. So she tried again. This time, husband told her how she ought to feel. We both began to laugh because it was such a silly impasse. We drew a diagram of what was happening. Wife was asking for such a simple thing, understanding. As soon as husband let her know that he understood how she felt, he moved emotionally close to her. Then she could accept the solutions he offered. Understanding is more important than solutions for our personal closeness, we discovered that night. And it's been true every night and every day since. You know, the blockage, these little things, don't present a strong crisis. It's not a bombshell like, say, adultery. But it's rather like the slow, steady buildup of cholesterol in the arteries, reducing the flow of nourishment to the limbs and organs and brains, a process that takes its toll only after long years. But it can be lethal. So let's be alert to our own methods of blocking communication and determine, with God's help, that we're going to stop them.
How you doing? You want to stand up a minute? Okay, let's do it. Everybody face that wall. Now give the person in front of you a neck rub. Okay, now turn around and do it the other way. Time-wise. What? What?
Oh, we're fine.
We're supposed to be done at 8:30?
Yeah, you're fine.
Okay, I can't finish in 5 minutes. Okay, have a seat. We're running out of time, so we're going to have to cut. I'm trying to figure out what to cut. I'm sure you're speaking for everyone. Let's talk for just a minute about communication styles. Negative and positive. There are certain messages that are really off limits for a married couple. We should never use them. And here they are. You never. You always. See, those are superlatives. We're human beings. It would be the rare human being who always does something. Always. That means every time. Without fail. We've got too many flaws in our makeup as human beings. So when you accuse somebody of always, you're out of bounds. And the same with never. Why can't you be more like, and you make a comparison with somebody else? Bad news. I don't know why I married you. I hate you. You're lucky I'm so understanding. That's your contradiction of terms, isn't it? Won't you ever learn? Won't you ever change? Huh. Well, we just need to... you want me to leave that on a minute? We just need to stay away from things like that. Let me mention a couple of other negative things. A couple of nevers. Number one, never use sarcasm in kidding and joking with one another. Now, I probably need to mellow that just a little bit, because maybe you can handle it in your relationship. We found that we couldn't. First 2 years we were married, we were living down in Dallas, Texas, and we began to develop this kind of fun little way of kidding and joking with one another using sarcasm. And the first few months, it was okay. We didn't have any double meanings to it. It was meant purely in humor, and it was kind of fun. We enjoyed it. But then as time went by and we continued to develop this, we both kind of learned independent of one another that we could use sarcasm and really have a little barb in it, but the other person didn't know for sure whether it had a barb in it or not. That's one of the beauties of sarcasm. And you know what sarcasm is. I mean, it's humor at the expense of somebody else. Basically, that's what it is. Well, then it continued to develop, and finally we reached the high plateau in sarcasm in our communication patterns of, can you top this? I would make a sarcastic crack to Carol, and then she felt the obligation to come back with a sarcastic remark, and then I had to top that. And then she would have to top me, and sometimes we would go back and forth 2 or 3 times that way. And by this time, we both began to realize that this was becoming hurtful to us as individuals and hurtful in our marriage relationship. It was right at that time that I was offered a job. Now, I was in seminary at the time, and it was during the summer, and that second summer that we were down in Dallas, I was offered a job as a youth pastor out in Pasadena, California. And so we packed everything up lock, stock, and barrel. And I mean, that didn't take much time because we were living in a 27-foot trailer. And we moved out to California for the summer. And this pastor and his wife at this church that we were working at were really a neat couple. We got to do all kinds of things with them, not just ministry, but we were thrown together socially in various kinds of situations. And about halfway through the summer, we'd been with them an awful lot, and they really had a great time together. You could tell that they enjoyed one another. They kidded around with each other. They'd pull little stunts on each other. But they never used sarcasm. And that became very noticeable to us. And so one night, we were out to dinner with him, and we asked him about this. We said, we've noticed this. And how come, you know, you guys have such a great relationship, and you have so much fun, but you never use sarcasm? And they said, well, let us tell you what happened. And they virtually repeated back to us our story, the first 2 years they were married. Just what I told you, what was happening to us. And they said, after about 2 years, we began to realize we really had a problem, and if we didn't solve it, it was going to damage irreparably our marriage in some areas. So one night, we sat down, on the edge of our bed in our bedroom, and we talked about it. And then we got down and we prayed about it. And we asked God to help us stop this habit. And after we got up off our knees, we not only had committed to God, but we committed to one another we were going to stop using sarcasm in kidding and joking with each other. And we knew that it was not going to be easy because it was such an ingrained habit with us by this time that it would come out, you know, without our even realizing it sometimes. Just automatic response. So we went one step further, they said. We committed to one another that we would be open and willing to have the other person call us on it when we did it. Not in front of other people, but later when we would get by ourselves. And we asked them, I think we asked them, how long did it take you to break the habit? They said, probably 3 or 4 months before we were so sensitized to it and conscious of it that we just almost virtually eliminated it from our vocabulary. Well, Carol and I went home that night. We got down on our knees beside our bed after talking about it for a while, and we committed to the Lord that we wanted to get rid of this habit and would He help us. And we did the same thing they did. We committed to one another that we were going to stop this habit. And if it meant being called on it, fine, okay. And they were right. It took us the better part of 4 months before we were so sensitized to sarcasm. Very seldom do we use it today. Our problem is, like you, we're human beings. And we blow it once in a while.
I did it right in the middle of a marriage seminar one time. I made a sarcastic remark about Carol. I not only had to apologize to her, I had to apologize to the whole audience. Gee. But you think about it. Maybe this is something that is an intruder that is not doing your communication patterns any good. And you ought to consider getting rid of it as a habit. Another never. Never interrupt, correct, or criticize your spouse in public. Never interrupt, correct, or criticize your spouse in public. We were having lunch with a couple of friends of ours recently. Hadn't seen them in a long time. And we were anxious to find out and get caught up on what had happened in their lives over the last couple of years, because it had been, well, probably 18 months since we'd seen them, and they had a lot to say, a lot to talk about. But they kept interrupting each other. Or they would start talking at the same time, and they wouldn't stop. They'd just both keep going. And finally, because we knew them well enough to do this, and also because we wanted to understand what they had to say, even though I got two ears, I can only listen to one voice. I stopped and I said, hey, wait a minute. One at a time. Well, fortunately, they were sharp people and they caught on quickly. And so from then on, the conversation went well. But you think how often that happens. You're with someone or you're in a group and the husband and the wife keep, it's a habit of life. They keep interrupting one another. It's a terrible habit. Or correcting. Now, Carol is a writer. And one thing I've learned about writers over the years is that they tend to exaggerate a little bit on certain things. I mean, it's just part of their nature. I remember one time, several years ago, we had a men's conference. This is when we were living back in the Chicago area. We had a men's conference up at Green Lake, Wisconsin, and it was over Thanksgiving weekend. It was a fantastic conference. There were 987 men there, and it was one of the most explosive weekends I think I've ever been at. So when I got home from that conference, I took more than 10 minutes to tell Carol about it. I really unloaded on her. And a couple of weeks later, I happened to be eavesdropping on a conversation that she was having with two or three of her friends, and she was telling them about this great conference, the men had up at Green Lake, Wisconsin, and there were just over 1,000 men there. And, you know, a couple of other exaggerations. Now, just 987 isn't just over 1,000, is it? No, it's just under 1,000. I mean, if you want to generalize, get it at least on the right side of 1,000. Now, what do you do in a situation like that? I know what some guys do. They barge in and they say, "Now, ladies, if you really want to know the straight scoop, I was there. There weren't just over 1,000 men there. That's a, man, she's blown it all out of proportion. There were 987 men there." That's not a very good idea, is it? I've done that a couple of times, and I've learned the hard way. So what I do in that situation, rather than trying to correct Carol or somebody else, really, is I take what I call the 20-year view. In other words, 20 years from now, will it really make any difference whether it was just over 1,000 or just under 1,000? And most of the time I come to the conclusion, no, it won't make any difference 20 years from now at all. So I keep my mouth shut. You listen to couples. Sometimes you listen to yourself. And watch the corrections that take place. I mean, they are really nitpicky. You know, it even goes beyond just over or just under 1,000. You know, they feel that they got, well, you know, we got there about 10 minutes to 2. No, honey, it wasn't. It was 10 minutes after 2. What the fat? Does it make any difference, really? Why do we have that compulsion to want to be so perfectionistic when it comes to things like that, to correct? See, what it does, it embarrasses our spouse when that happens, in front of other people, now I'm talking about. You see, I'm the president of the Carol Mayhall Fan Club. You probably have guessed that by now, but I've been that for years. Now, the reason that I am the president of the Carol Mayhall Fan Club is not because she's such a beautiful woman, which she is, I feel. Fantastic cook. She's been a wonderful mother to our daughter. She's a terrific grandmother to our grandkids. Great wife. Excellent speaker to women's groups and other groups. Those are not the reasons that I'm the president of the Carol Mayhall Fan Club. The reason that I am the president of the Carol Mayhall Fan Club is because I love her. I love her. And because I love her, I want her to look good in the eyes of other people. I don't want to embarrass her in front of other people by correcting her in front of them, by interrupting her. So, you know, where are you on this matter? Is it something you need to work on? And, of course, criticism. That's just out to lunch. I don't know how many times I have been with a group of husbands and we're going somewhere in a car and they start talking about their wives. The old bag, the ball and chain, you know. Just absolutely dumb stuff. But it tells me where they are in their marriage relationship. There's no way in the world I would talk about Carol that way. No way. We better quit, huh? Okay, one more. What do you do? This is not exactly a never, but it's a little problem that all of us face as married couples. What do you do? How do you handle the situation when your spouse does or says something repeatedly that irritates you? You know, they got this little habit, and they do it over and over and over again. Every time they do it, or every time they say it just that way, it just kind of irks you down inside. What do you do about that? One of the last places we lived, we had a shower that had two faucets. Didn't have one of these kind that you mix the water with. You had to turn on the cold and the hot and get them balanced just right. I can't tell you how many times I'd go in to take a shower after she had been in there taking a shower, and I'd reach in to get the faucets adjusted just right, and instead of getting a hold of the nice, shiny faucets, I'd get a hold of a wet, soggy, soapy washcloth draped over the faucets. Have you ever felt something like that? I mean, it is absolutely yucky. And of course, I'd grab the washcloth and I'd wring it out and throw it in the sink and take my shower. Then it happened again, and again, and again. So one day, after we'd been out to dinner, I picked my place, picked the time. We had a lovely dinner together, candlelight, lovely time. And after dinner was over, we were having a nice exchange verbally. And I brought this up in a nice way, nice tone of voice, not angry, nothing like that. And I said, "Sweetheart, you know, there's something that's been going on for some time, and it kind of gets to me when it happens." And I explained this to her. She listened very empathetically. And she said, "You know, honey, I can understand why you feel that way. But you know, there's no place else to hang the washcloth. Do you suppose that you could put up a little towel bar right outside the shower, so that then I could have a place to hang that washcloth?" You know, I'd never thought about that. So we got home, and the first thing I did, I went up and went in the bathroom and I looked to see, you know, was there enough wall space right there where she was thought, and there was. There was enough room to put about an 18-incher towel bar right there on that wall. So the next day I went down to the hardware store, I got a little towel bar and I brought it home, put it up. And, you know, it solved the problem. From then on, she'd take a shower, she'd wring out the washcloth, open the door, hang it on that towel bar, and I didn't get a hold of a wet, soggy, soapy washcloth after that. But you know what we had to do in order to solve that problem? We had to talk about it. We had to talk about it. Communication. Now, you would think that a nice guy like me would never have any problems like that would irritate my wife. Just looking at me, you could tell that, couldn't you? We used to have we still have it, but it was in a different house than we're living in now. And it's a chest of drawers. It's got about 8 drawers, you know, stands about this high. And I'd be getting ready for bed at night, and I'd take off my pants. I usually do take off my pants before I go to bed. And I would turn it upside down, get the cuffs together, and I'd open the top drawer, that chest of drawers, and put the cuffs in, and then close the drawer. And it really makes the neatest pants hanger you've ever seen. And it's so fast. I didn't even have to go into the closet to do it. Sometimes I'd get 2 or 3 pair of pants hanging in there. The only problem was that top drawer was Carol's. Her stuff was in that drawer. And once in a while, I would walk in the bedroom when she was over there trying to get something out of that drawer, and I'd have a couple of pair of pants hanging in it, and I'd kind of see out of the corner of my eye, you know, that she was... But I figured, that's her problem. Until one day she brought it up. And she was very sweet about it. She said, "Honey," something like this. She said, "Honey, do you know the proper place for pants to be hung at night?" I said, you couldn't mean the closet, could you?" She says, "Well, yeah, it's kind of like the car. The car goes in the garage at night, and your pants should go in the closet at night." She says, "You suppose you could develop the habit of hanging your pants in the closet?" I said, sure, I can do that. Well, bless her heart, you know what she did? She went down and she got me some pants hangers. They are the neatest things. They're wire, and you just squeeze them, and they come open. You put the pants in, you squeeze it down here, and it clamps on the pants, and you just put it on the bar in the closet, and man, just like that, it's done. So it solved the problem. But you know what we had to do? We had to talk about it. Yeah, we had to talk about it. See, communication is the key to so many things in our marriage relationship. Every kind of situation. However, you also notice that timing and tone of voice is important when you're dealing with issues like this. You got to be gentle. You got to handle it right. Well, we better quit. We're way over time. You've been very patient. Let's close in a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for this great adventure that you brought us all into called marriage. And I pray that these things that we're talking about will be of benefit in some small way to each one of us, individually as a husband and a wife, and also as couples. Father, we thank you for the reminders that you give to Carol and me just by doing a seminar like this. And then as we go through life and we interact and we come up against different and new situations, Father, keep our hearts open to you to be willing to learn, to grow, to change, to become a better man, a better woman, more Christ-like in our demeanor. Lord, give us the discipline, the courage, the commitment that we need to really make our marriage a priority in the totality of our life. And most of all, Lord, as we get to know you better and better, which I trust we will, day by day, that we'll be more sensitive to the Spirit of God as he speaks to us through your word, and that that will reflect in the way that we act and respond to one another as a husband and a wife. And that response will be a godly one. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.